Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. It seems that the Memorial Day weekend was shot full of holes with at least 11 mass shootings, which are defined as four or more people are shot or killed, not including the shooter. At least seven people were killed and 49 wounded during the holiday. On Friday, before the start of the Memorial Day weekend, three children, ages 3, 4, and 6, were murdered as well as their mother in Mecosta County, Michigan. Perhaps the mass murders of Americans on U.S. soil should be commemorated with a Memorial Day on their behalf. Of course, making such a public remembrance of homicide into a three-day holiday, as we treat the country's war dead, might be somewhat unsavory. Yet the nation's mass gunshot deaths are a plague on all our houses and also schools. The USA is suffering a gundemic plague. The Oregon and Washington coasts are in danger this third summer season of coronavirus, of an explosive inflammation of the plague, because so many Americans are tired of lockdown and want normalcy, which will most likely spread it like a prairie fire if they wantonly flock to the local beaches as expected. I start today's program with an annual dose of silly season avarice, which in better times resembles a summer gold rush, which I pontificate about on this program, plague or no plague, annually. Everybody wants a cut of the tourist buck. Tourism attempts to fill the void left by depleted natural resources, whose exploitation built and sustained the local coastal culture until the forests were cut down and the great fish runs decimated by the impetuous greed of white settlers and their descendants. A magnificent land that had thrived for millennia was ravaged in a century. Now, sultans of fun replace loggers and fisher people. They build shopping centers and malls, condominiums, bigger and glitzier motels, restaurants and bars that remove the remaining trees and block ocean views. Cannon Beach, which in an earlier era resisted opportunities to be a second Carmel, has acquiesced and booms like a gold strike town. Seaside mixed its sand with water and remade its graceful downtown into a cement mall. Astoria hustles its failed history and Carpenter Gothic houses to draw tourists from the beach towns. Complaints about tourism are usually whines about discourtesies, inconveniences, and crowds of noisy, fussy, impatient strangers. But sometimes criticisms are registered about the sort of environment that is being imposed upon a previously neglected string of coastal towns and the ambivalence of residents between tourist revenues and environmental quality. The current practices of coastal entrepreneurship are a local symptom of a national malady, that money is all that counts, and anything in the way of making a buck deserves to be deep-sixed. Tourism has a habit of destroying what it seeks, and amidst the commercial glitter and singing cash registers, the real gold is slipping out of our hands. Connie Anderson, who used to live in Cannon Beach, and in 1980 wrote an article for the North Coast Times Eagle, A Short History of Seaside, perceived clearly the changes tourism has wrought. And this is by Connie Anderson. Somewhere behind the pavement, the aluminum-framed junk-filled windows, the traffic, the pinball machines and snow cone litter, lurks the ghost of a pretty little beach town, a town that welcomed progress as a friend, resisted not at all, and in the short span of a person's lifetime, died under its feet with little more than a whimper. Seaside, whatever it is today, is not a pretty little town, either in physical appearance or character. The Oregon coast wears on its shores a string of such pretty little towns, Cannon Beach, Manzanita, Nehalem, all today facing the same forces and models of thinking which have transformed so many of Oregon's coastal gems into a string of tasteless clunkers. Like Godzilla in the greenhouse, the tourist industry is a powerful force plowing through the small town's natural environment, leaving in its wake a trail of highway architecture, parking lots, condominiums, mobile home courts, souvenir junk outlets, and the threat of legalized gambling. And the pretty little town loses more than just its physical beauty to the impersonal wasteland of the commercially controlled tourist trap. It loses its small town energy and character, which are the truest sources of its beauty and grace, and which loss no cosmetic compromise by developers can remedy or replace. And that was a segment written by Connie Rose Anderson, who used to live in Cannon Beach. And now, Bloody Monday. May 11, 1970 was not only the 178th anniversary of Boston Captain Robert Gray's claimed discovery of the great river he named Columbia after his ship, Columbia Rediviva, Columbus Revived. It became a noteworthy as well as violent moment of resistance to the Vietnam War as a result of attack by club-wielding police at Portland State University. A 50th anniversary program for Bloody Monday, in which Portland police destroyed a makeshift but viable hospital tent at Portland State University, was postponed 2 years ago in 2020 until this May 11th as a result of pandemic. David Horowitz, professor emeritus at TSU, organized the commemorative ceremony and placement of a plaque at the university in honor of a once famous and certainly infamous assault on a peaceful demonstration against a dreadful and nearly perpetual war that was ultimately a costly failure. This is what David Horowitz had to say, along with several other speakers at the revived Bloody Monday anniversary. There must be some way out of here is a challenge I have pondered about American politics since I entered adult life in 1959. When I came to Portland State to teach history 9 years later, I accepted the new left view of the Vietnam War as a chapter in imperial history. I would modify that belief over the years, but never forgot that the technological violence directed against a people seeking to chart their own destiny had been made in my name. Stories of the good Germans who had gone about their business while the Nazis systematically extinguished the lives of millions of Europeans haunted me, as did the realization that my class privilege as a student had spared me the draft. I came to Portland vowing I would do everything to support the anti-war movement. By May 1970, 50,000 U.S. service personnel had been killed in Vietnam. Yet those seeking an end to the war could easily believe the philosopher Albert Camus's warning that one can be right and yet be beaten. Force can vanquish spirit, quote unquote. The decision to bear nonviolent witness to the removal of the medical tent was a collective effort to say the movement was not going away. As a faculty member who participated in the protest, I have been honored to play a part in placing the strike within the university's institutional memory. Yet the organizers of this event are hoping to pass something of value onto those coming into their own political maturity. This is a challenge in today's widely changed political universe. Some 30% of the American public now appears open to the imposition of harsh social morality codes on their adversaries, the denial of the protection of the law for those whom they despise, the abrogation of voting and human rights for their opponents, and the right to overthrow elections that don't go their way. Some have even forged alliances with authoritarian figures overseas. In short, democracy is in peril. Without it, none of the substantive changes activists call for are possible. The good news is that the coming decades can produce the greatest generation in American history if democracy is to be saved. Yet young people and progressives cannot do this alone. They will need to engage the 40% of the country exhausted by political divisiveness and anxious to see which cohort threatens its core values and interests. Advocates of needed reform are in good position to play this game, but three cautions should be kept in mind. 1. Social goals must be framed within the sensibilities and interests of broad communities and the public good. Barack Obama understood this when he advocated Black Lives Matter, no more, no less. 2. Street protests cannot become vehicles for nihilist exhibitionism and display. Articulating the existence of grievances is not the same as summoning the strategic agility to resolve them. 3. Selection and support of political candidates must go beyond matters of cultural style and aspirational rhetoric to embrace leaders who can win the confidence of a broad coalition of voters and govern with reasoned empathy. This is not a time for happy talk when the stakes are so serious. A passage from Scripture seems timely. Let us stop talking falsely now. The prophet from Minnesota's North Woods once pleaded, the hour is getting late. And that was by David A. Horowitz from the Department of History, Portland State University. And of course, if anybody has to guess who the prophet from Minnesota's North Woods is, Bob Dylan. And now, something again that I wrote, A New Civil War. A few years ago, a man who claimed leadership of anti-abortion crusades at abortion clinics compared the U.S. Supreme Court decision Roe versus Wade, which he said transferred the right to abortion from women to the state, to the Dred Scott decision of 1857, which was a major factor that precipitated the Civil War. Scott, a slave, sued the Supreme Court for his freedom. Slave owners and their political judicial cronies insisted the court reject Scott's claim of citizenship because he was a slave, which meant he was hardly human. Abolitionists attempted to convince the court that all persons were human beings and entitled to citizenship and freedom. Chief Justice Taney declared that the original intent of the Constitution favored only the freedom and citizenship of white men. The general consensus among the founding fathers, and long afterward, he said, was that Negroes were, quote, so far inferior that they had no rights that a white man was bound to respect, unquote. The net effect of the Dred Scott decision was to make the issue of slavery too explosive for political or judicial settlement. It was later termed a monumental indiscretion and a public calamity. Justice Felix Frankfurter once remarked that Supreme Court justices never mentioned Dred Scott after the Civil War anymore, he said, than a family whose son had been hanged mentioned ropes or scaffold. The probable abortion decision by the Republican majority on the Supreme Court follows the same unfortunate premise. Women are not citizens. They do not have the right to make elemental choices about abortion. The hypocrisy is that women have had to make these decisions for thousands of years. Women have been responsible for birth control or forced to be instruments of euthanasia in regards to unwanted children in the vacuum left by irresponsible men. Abortion at least allows a woman to dispose of an unwanted child before it is born. For some reason, men who abdicate the responsibility for birth control yet believe they should control a woman's options, which has less to do with concern for the unborn fetus than it does retaining supremacy over women. Women are not allowed to be free and equal citizens. For that matter, more than a century after emancipation, neither are black people, who wish to be known as Afro-Americans, in recognition of their long presence in this hemisphere. Humanity is crowding itself off its home planet. Abortion is a survival mechanism that attempts, consciously or subliminally, to alleviate the ever-increasing ravage of the earth by an overabundant species that seldom practices successful birth control. In the bad old days, children were abandoned or slaughtered when a population overran its resources. Abortion is a much preferable option than an AIDS epidemic in stabilizing population growth. Yet, as with slavery, abortion causes furious arguments and is such an emotional issue that a civil war of sorts is in the process of erupting. Nothing has been settled by the Supreme Court, which has enraged both sides, so-called pro-life and pro-choice. The court erroneously made a political decision instead of an impartial, constitutionally rooted judgment that ultimately satisfies no one. Like the 3/5 compromise that allowed that much, but no more consideration of being human beings to slaves, the Supreme Court has declared that women are so far inferior that they have no rights a man is bound to respect. That was something I wrote for my old newspaper, the North Coast Times-Eagle, A New Civil War, which is even newer now. And now, by Robin Sawyer, who used to live in Seaside, here comes your ghost again, which is quoted from Diamonds and Rust by Joan Baez. Years ago, I was moving an old couch for a dear friend who was many years my senior. The couch had been stored on a porch for several years and had been exposed to quite a bit of moisture. As I lifted an end of the couch, I noticed a paper bag between the cushions. I picked the bag up and began to throw it aside when my curiosity kicked in. I opened the sack and was very surprised to find the likeness of Adolf Hitler staring me in the face. I showed the stamp collection in the bag to my friend, who said, "Take it and see if you can get a couple of bucks for it." There was something strange about the tone of her voice, and I didn't question her about the stamps. It was obvious, however, that someone had collected the stamps in Nazi Germany, and they had somehow ended up on Jean's back porch. She would have been about 25 when World War II ended. Nearly all of the stamps were badly water damaged, but the story they told was fascinating. There were stamps commemorating Hitler's 55th birthday, April 20th, 1944, and stamps meant to immortalized the assassinated second in command of the SS, Heydrich. Hitler and Mussolini stood looking out over a town, like shepherds of men, benevolent leaders. The symbol of the SS was on another stamp. Images of Hitler and swastikas were glorified throughout the collection. As I looked through them, the strange tone in Jean's voice did not seem so odd. The troubled economy in pre-Nazi Germany was partially responsible for one of the darkest times in history. The German people were looking for something to blame their troubles on, and a group of people who did not believe that Christ was the Son of God made an excellent repository for the flood of anger filling the country. Today, we wonder how a nation could allow the manifestations of hell on earth. A nation of Christians, among others, we wonder how another could allow entire families to be slaved, beaten, tortured, and murdered. 30-odd years I've watched the log trucks roll out of Oregon's hills. The trucks have steadily become fewer, and the trees they haul become progressively smaller. Oregon's troubled timber industry is one part of the weakening American economy. People are rightfully afraid that our days of prosperity are drawing to a close. The political and economic leaders who have failed us are looking for someone to blame. Unfortunately, for our failed leaders, Americans don't collectively blame Jews these days. Instead, a new immorality must be found. A group of people different from most of us, or another species that stands in the way of progress. The politicians are looking for scapegoats to blame their failures on. 50 years from now, we will be remembered as the people who were duped into blaming owls and homosexuals for things they had no control over. I look at myself with the rest of you and wonder, can we really be such fools? All my life, I've tried to understand the differences between people. After all, it's a lack of cooperation that is responsible for most of our problems. No matter how hard I try, I can never understand people like David Duke of the KKK. How can people be so consumed with hatred and call themselves Christians? Even atheists can see the hypocrisy that so many self-proclaimed Christians are blind to. Darwin would find himself more welcome in heaven than the self-righteous hypocrites passing judgment around this country. Although I disagree with most of David Duke's philosophy, I believe he chose the right political party to affiliate himself with. David Duke seems to be part of the natural devolution of the Republican Party. Having no power, money, or influence, I often wonder why I bother worrying about guys like Duke, Ron Mabon, and the rest of the people Gandhi said would eventually fall. Then I think of the alternative to opposing the oppression of free people. I think of the real story behind those stamps, and suddenly I am very afraid, but very motivated. Those of us who have known Anne Frank and forgotten her have lost our souls with her memory. And that was Here Comes Your Ghost Again by Robin Sawyer, who actually wrote that article for the North Coast Times Eagle in 1992. This is Michael McCusker. Nick Stevens is engineer of today's program. Today, June 2nd, would be my deceased father, William Copeland McCusker's 109th birthday. He died on February 6, 1998. Born on 6-2, died on 2-6, 84 years in between. When he was a boy, his family moved from Illinois to Southern California, which was lush with orange trees. One day when he was about 12, he ate so many oranges from a tree he sat under that he could not move for hours. He always quietly laughed when he explained that he accumulated so much sugar in his bloodstream from the oranges that he was helplessly cataleptic for most of that day. Don't be lackadaisical about Corona 19. It is not over yet. And being careless about exposure ensures its continuance. And once again, it will be a plague on all our houses. Don't be stupid this silly season.